Well, there are two passages of Scripture we're going to look at this morning. One is found in the first chapter of John's Gospel, the other in the ninth chapter of the prophet Isaiah. Now, before we read this, there is one other announcement I want to draw your attention to. If you look on the back of page 5 of your sermon notes, you'll see an advertisement that the Westminster Bookstore in Philadelphia is making available at a very discounted rate the newest translation of John Calvin's classic Institutes of the Christian Religion in one volume, along with a guide to Christian living. This offer ends on the 7th of October, which is Tuesday. So I would encourage you to go online and place an order. For $35, you can have this set. This translation is from the 1541 French edition of the Institutes. Now, I have in my library the two translations that were made from the Latin, the first by James Beveridge, which was made in the 19th century, and then in the 20th century, Ford Lewis Battles did perhaps the best known translation. But this one is by Robert White, who is a French scholar. Now, you know that Calvin was French, and he wrote the Institutes not only in Latin, but in French. And one of the reasons that this edition may have some gold to be mined from the other, that the others do not, is because Calvin had time to reflect upon what he had written in Latin, so that when he wrote the French, and he was a master of prose and style. Calvin's Latin is very much classical. If you ever had to translate in a theological exam, Calvin's Latin is stylistic. He was trained as a humanist scholar. And his French has the same kind of flow to it. So I would encourage you, even if you have a Latin translation of the Institutes, get this one as well. So that's enough of salesmanship. Let us read from John chapter 1, verses 1 through 18, a well-known text. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things were made through Him. And without Him was not anything made that was made. In Him was life, and the life was the light of men. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. There was a man sent from God whose name was John. He came as a witness to bear witness about the light, that all might believe through him. He was not the light, but came to bear witness about the light. The true light, which enlightens everyone, was coming into the world. He was in the world, and the world was made through him, yet the world did not know him. He came to his own, and his own people did not receive him. But to all who did receive him, who believe in his name, he gave the right to become children of God, who were born not of blood, nor the will of flesh, nor the will of man, but of God. And the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. And we have seen His glory, glory as of the only Son from the Father, full of grace and truth. John bore witness about Him and cried out, "This was He of whom I said, 'He who comes after me ranks before me because he was before me.' And from his fullness we have received grace upon grace. For the law was given through Moses. Grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. No one has ever seen God, the only God, who is at the Father's side. He has made him known." Now then, go over to Isaiah chapter 9. Another text that most of you have heard repeatedly, especially at Christmas time, when Handel's Messiah is performed. Beginning in verse 2, "The people who walked in darkness have seen a great light, and those who dwell in a land of deep darkness, on them has light shined. You have multiplied the nations, you have increased its joy. They rejoice before you at the joy at the harvest, and they are glad when they divide the spoils. For the yoke of his burden and the staff of his shoulder and the rod of his oppressor you have broken as on the day of Midian. For every boot of the trampling warrior in the battle tumult and every garment rolled in blood will be burned as fuel for fire. For to us a child is born, for to us a son is given, and the government shall be upon his shoulder, and his name shall be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Of the increase of his government and of his peace, there will be no end. On the throne of David and over his kingdom to establish it and to uphold it, with justice and with righteousness from this time forth and forevermore. The zeal of the Lord of hosts will do this." Handel originally wrote his famous Messiah at the time of Easter, but it has become associated with Christmas because of the mention of the birth of the Christ child. Did you know that he wrote this in less than 3 weeks? They said he literally worked from sunup till sundown. He was so carried away with what he was writing. He was the son of a very devout Christian who was a surgeon, and he had intended his son to be a lawyer, but by the age of 9 he had displayed such musical prowess that they said, "We have a prodigy on our hands here." And sure enough, when he was still a young man, he began to amaze people by his ability as both a composer and a musician, and of course this is his best known work. Now, it's always done at Christmas time, and I always enjoy watching the Mormon Tabernacle Choir perform it. They're quite gifted and talented, but it's one of those pieces that has come to be associated with Christmas, and yet the import of what the text is saying is lost on 99% of the population who hear it, because the whole nature of the incarnation is a mystery to the natural man. The birth of Christ, by the way, it was stated here just a few weeks ago. You know that the atheists have become extremely aggressive. You have not only Richard Dawkins, but Samuel Harris and others of that ilk who have become best-selling authors. The New York Times advertises theirs. And Sam Harris and these others have said that if there was one person that they would, if they had the ability to go back in a time machine and abort, you would think that it would be, you know, someone like Adolf Hitler or somebody of that caliber. No, it would be Christ. They would kill the Christ child because that would put an end to Christianity, which they despise. And it's just symptomatic of what the Apostle Paul talks about when he says that we live in a fallen culture and people suppress the truth in unrighteousness. This text is much like the background to the one we looked at last week in Galatians chapter 4, where Paul says, "In the fullness of time, God sent his son, born of a woman, born under the law." And the purpose for his incarnation and the purpose of his coming is stated explicitly in his atoning death. Isaiah likewise underscores the condition in which Christ came, in which the world was. He says, "People who walked in darkness." And this is a description very much like what the Salvador Declaration was talking about, and how our whole beings have been defiled by sin, so that darkness, not light, is what characterizes us. These people who walk in darkness. This is, again, a term that Paul uses likewise in Ephesians 2 that we looked at last week, that we were children of wrath and we conducted ourselves just like everybody else did, living in the desires of the mind and of the body, and were children of disobedience. So these people walk in darkness and they dwell in a land, notice this, of deeper darkness. And it describes the pathetic situation in which humanity finds itself as a result of sin. But then we have this statement before you get to the announcement of the birth of this special child, of how there will be a multiplication of joy and that people will rejoice. And he uses the illustration of what happened back in the 8th chapter of the book of Judges, in which, you remember, the Midianites were routed by Gideon and his little band. But if you remember how the narrative goes, they didn't do anything except take torches and put them inside clay lamps and then shatter it. And the Lord brought a confusion upon the Midianites, and they began to slay each other in the darkness. And so there was a great victory and there was a great spoil when Gideon and his men came upon the booty. And so that's what he's alluding to here. He said, there will be this harvest as they divide the spoil. And it's basically a way of describing the results of what this one who is uniquely qualified to liberate them from the bondage and the darkness which they lived. And then you have a description of the character of this special person. For unto us a child is born. Now notice the careful selection of words. A child is born. A son is given. You know that back in the 7th chapter, Isaiah speaks of the virgin giving birth, the famous announcement that he will be virgin born because he is a miracle child. But he is born a son, and you have combined in this one verse the uniqueness of what the Heidelberg Catechism is talking about. Very man, he is one of us, he has our human nature, but he is at the same time very God. The Son is given. You have this allusion from Isaiah that John picks up throughout his gospel, especially in the 1st chapter, but also in the 3rd chapter. For God so loved the world that he gave his Son. This is the Son of which Isaiah speaks. And then there is the description of his unique character. He shall be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God. That expression, wonderful, the Hebrew root there, which is used elsewhere in Scripture about things that are so awe-inspiring they take people's breath away. And especially are they used to describe how God deals with his enemies in judgment. The wonders that he performed in Egypt. The plagues. You know, there is a principle embedded in this text that we should never lose sight of. That is, God's way of dealing with sin is judgment. He judges it. He doesn't perform some kind of sleight of hand where now you see it, now you don't. Notice that the darkness that envelops us is an enemy, an oppressor. Darkness is a euphemism for Satan's activity in blinding men. Paul says to Timothy that he has blinded men and taken them captive. And we were likewise like that, blinded. And so God executes judgment. And this judgment is said to be awe-inspiring. People wonder at it. He is wonderful counsel of a mighty God. The Hebrew expression there is El Gibor, and it refers to his might. And I've said this many times, the scripture likens God's creative forces to his handiwork, something he does with his fingers. But when he sets out to accomplish the redemption of sinners, the images of him rolling up his sleeve and baring his arm, because now strength is required. You know, you might think that creation is the greatest manifestation of the power of God. And when we look at the magnificent creation that we have around us and the entire scope of the universe, it's baffling to think, well, that's something God did, you know, leisurely. But when he set about to redeem a fallen creation, now something else is required. And that harkens back up to that text in Galatians. Here we have a situation where this child is born in this environment where darkness reigns supreme. Paul says in Galatians 4, Christ was born under the law and all of its force, its stipulations, its mandates. See, the law was never designed to liberate men from the bondage of sin. It just increases and amplifies the severity of it. Christ is born under the law. That is the description in which he comes as a child of Adam, but as the offspring of the root of the house of David. He is not of the tribe of Levi. He is not of the Aaronic priesthood. He carries a special priesthood. His is the priesthood that the writer to the Hebrews tells us, excuse me, is that of Melchizedek. And notice he is also described as everlasting father. That is, you know, in Psalm 90, there's a psalm of Moses where the psalmist says, from everlasting to everlasting, before the mountains were formed, before the earth was, you are God. And it's a description of God's eternality. He is Lord of time. This one who comes in the fullness of time is the Lord of time and eternity. And the Prince of Peace is a description of the accomplishment of his work, because he establishes peace, as Paul tells us in Romans, by his blood. It is through his death. And in his death, what happens? You know, the doctrine of the atonement has come under severe attack, especially the doctrine of penal substitutionary atonement, that Christ bore the wrath of God in the place of sinners. That is said to be something that our sensitivities cannot abide by. It speaks of cosmic child abuse. And in our society in which domestic violence is suddenly on the front page, the notion that God would punish his own son seemed to contribute to the notion that God was this tyrannical father inflicting his wrath upon his son, unwilling son. But that's not what Scripture says. God's love is the great manifestation in that he spared not his own son. That which was the closest to him in the bosom of the Father, the Son, is now given. And when he says he is given over to judgment. And he experiences the fullness of the wrath of this almighty being. By the way, it's not just the Father. It is the triune God who is at work in the atoning sacrifice of Christ. And so he is the Prince of Peace. And then when it speaks of the increase of his government, he's not talking about an earthly government. You know, we have to go through this every so often. Rapture mania is now back upon us because they've made a full-fledged movie, another one, Left Behind, this one with Nicolas Cage, and there are all kinds of prophetic speculations about how this fulfills the end-time scenario, that Christ is going to return and establish his earthly kingdom. That's not what this is talking about. Jesus said expressly that my kingdom is not of this world. He is going to establish his kingdom in the hearts and lives of his people. And eventually there will be an ushering in of the new heavens and new earth, over which he shall reign, as the text says, upon his father's throne, David. But this is not speaking of a theocratic earthly kingdom like Israel enjoyed in the Old Testament. This is speaking of Christ's spiritual reign and rule, and that his church is going to prevail, and the gates of hell shall notwithstanding stop it. Isn't this encouraging? Because look at how it ends. The zeal of the Lord of hosts will do this. You know, Paul speaks of the Jews having a zeal for godliness, but not according to knowledge, that they pursued it with a passion. And we see that in the lives of people that you can admire, like Handel. He had a zeal that he poured his life into his music, and it was commendable. And it is commendable for people to be devoted to accomplishing something that they have the ability to do. Notice it says, the zeal of the Lord of hosts will accomplish this, and nothing shall stop him. And it speaks of his sovereignty to do it, that he will work in the lives of those who were the object of his redeeming love, and he will accomplish it. What is it the Apostle Paul says? He who began a good work in you will continue it. And that we're to work out our salvation in fear and trembling, because God is going to do something. You know, Christians have a tendency, especially evangelical Christians, to be caught up in the whole concept of transforming culture. We've got to bring God back into our public schools. We've got to have the Ten Commandments in our courthouses. And that somehow we've got to elect the right officials so that we once again can become a Christian nation. You're chasing a fool's dream there. That's not going to happen. Paul never expected that as the result of the gospel spreading throughout the Roman Empire, that the Roman Empire would be Christianized. Yes, Christianity would exercise an influence, and societies and civilizations who have had the influence of Christianity have profited from it. Now we're witnessing, not only in Europe but here, the total de-Christianization of our society. And people get all up in arms like, oh, what are we going to do? You know, Christianity is becoming more and more despised. The cultural elite despise Christianity. They don't have anything to do with it. News for you. The zeal of the Lord of hosts will not be diminished or dampened by the turn of the political tides and the winds as they blow through our culture. Christ is going to rule and reign until he has put all his enemies under his feet. That's the significance of Christmas. And you can understand now why people don't care about that message. And so we substitute Christmas with all kinds of things. Santa Claus, reindeer, giving of gifts, which are in themselves innocuous. But when they crowd out the message of who this was that was born and what he will do and what he has done, people don't want to hear about that Christ. They want the Hallmark Jesus, the gentle Jesus in the manger with a halo glowing around his head. The Jesus who comes in the book of Revelation mounted on a white steed with a powerful sword and his angels in force, who will subdue all of his enemies. That Jesus they want nothing to do with. And yet, that is the Jesus and the only one that can save them from their ultimate peril, which is the righteous judgment of God. Each Lord's Day, we celebrate what that means when we observe the Lord's Supper.